You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
My guest today is Richard Sitowick, who is a professor of neurology at George Washington University and holds an MFA in creative writing. His New York Times magazine cover story about Presidential Press Secretary James Brady received a 1982 Pulitzer nomination. He's written some books. He's got a new one, which is called Your Stone Age Brain in the Screen Age. Enjoy the pod.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job, at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Richard Sitowick, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Your new book starts with an explanation of how our contemporary brain evolved. You write, quote, "Stone Age humans are highly sensitive not only to wanting and reward, but also to reinforcement." And you go on to say, "Reinforcement leads to habits, good and bad, which then become established as part of a larger cultural traditions. So the problem here is that tech companies, they know all this, and they exploit that knowledge for profit and edge.
Absolutely.
Yeah, talk about that.
Well, I mean, you know, everybody knows about Pavlov's dogs. I mean, that's classic conditioning reinforcement. So what's even more powerful than that is positive intermittent reinforcement. And that's what a slot machine is, basically, is that you get a hit sometimes on a random schedule that's unpredictable. And so when you get a little dopamine rush, you know, you get a small payout, then you get a larger payout, you keep playing thinking, I'm going to get a big hit. And so this is what the endless scroll of the phone does, is that we get something that's funny or amusing or sexy or politically engaging, and we want to keep going until we get some more of that. And you know, unless you're a glutton, when we eat, there's a signal that says, okay, I'm full, I've had enough, I'm going to push away from the table, leave the plate alone, okay? Mm-hmm. But when you're scrolling on the infinite scroll, what is the signal that says, oh, you better stop now, you've had enough of this? Because there's never enough of it. That's why it's called the endless scroll. And behavioral economists, which are hired, and psychologists, which are hired in droves by these tech companies, they know this, and their job is to keep us engaged on their platforms as long as possible. Tech companies know that there's only 1,440 minutes in a day, and they fight ruthlessly for our eyeballs because all their competitors are doing the same thing. And the bottom line is what? Money.
Yeah, yeah. There is a kind of a pub that opened in my neighborhood that I was so happy about. It's called the Green Post. And I'm a big soccer fan, so they show the soccer games on the screens. When there is not a soccer game, those screens are just art.
Oh, how nice.
And it's letting, because my wife just, if there's screens all over a restaurant, she will not go in. And I was on a call yesterday where someone's talking about, we need more screens in downtown Chicago. And I'm just listening to this going, no, we don't.
This is why I say screens are like secondhand smoke. Yeah. They insist on being looked at. And we've all experienced this in waiting rooms and airport lounges. If there's a big screen on, particularly if it's got the crawl with the news going at the bottom, we cannot help but look at it. And in fact, trying not to look takes more energy if in terms of the brain is concerned, then does paying attention to something. And this is one of the other things, my other approach is to look at this issue in terms of engineering and energy cost. What does it cost to have a certain thought, to do a certain action, etc.? And you see, most people don't think this way. Most people have no need to think about that the way that they think or how that they think or even that they have a brain. And to think about this sometimes seems weird to people, but it's my profession. So I think like this all the time. So when I first realized, when I first got my iPhone, and this was years after having had just track phones, my husband and I were in New York and we were trying to find a certain store or restaurant, and we couldn't find it. I mean, this is a city set up on a grid, for God's sake. So we couldn't find it. And by that time, all the public telephones and phone books had been ripped out. So we just looked at each other and said, we have got to get an iPhone, if only for the maps. So we got them. And within a day and a half, I said, oh my God, no wonder everybody says these things are so addictive. There it was, because of my sensitivity to the issue, is like, look what this thing is doing to my brain. But most people don't think that way. They think the battle is between them and these external devices. And so if only they can have more technology to act as a buffer between that technology, and it goes, I mean, it's an endless loop. But the real problem isn't us versus it. It's us versus ourselves. And I see that's what catches people by surprise.
And the power of these devices, first of all, I think it was Adam Alter at NYU in one of his books, and we had him on the pod, was talking about, even if it's upside down on an office table between you and someone else, your attention is...
The flash of the screen is, and the whoosh, if there is a whoosh for the text notification, it's going to seize your attention. And there have been experiments done where they had students do some sort of easy test. And if the testers put your phone in another room, you did the best. If it was just face down on the desk next to you, you did pretty poorly. And the worst performers were the ones who had the phones with them all the time.
And then I think in the book you talk about a comparison of that phone that's in, you know, our pocket, compared to like NASA sending people on the moon in the 60s, right? It's maybe even more powerful than some of their technology.
I mean, this little device, this little computer in my hand, it's better than Star Trek, for God's sakes. I mean, I remember watching the moon landing in 1969, and when the LEM took off from the moon to return to Earth, I was absolutely flabbergasted that it was in color. I said, because I expected it would be in black and white back then. There was a lot of shows were in black and white. I thought, oh my God, we've got color TV from the moon. So today I use that example and say, why can't these technological devices just fix themselves rather than having us have to call technical support and all that? So now they fixed us really well. They fixed us into a real bind. And people don't realize they're addicted. You show them the evidence and they deny it. You show them how poorly they are at multitasking and they insist, no, I'm good at this.
Is that because we were such storytelling creatures that we're just trying to tell ourselves a story in which there's not a problem and everything's going fine? I mean, or is it more just is it classic human behavior?
I think it's just classic behavior. I mean, the reason we have stories is because they told people who went before us how things were and how they ended. And so they're a source of comfort for us, you know? So if you go look at stories, you can find cautionary ones like, you know, the boy who goes into the wood to find a pot of gold and he comes out and it's turned to ash. You know, or the goose that laid the golden egg. You know, you kill the goose, you kill the song, etc. You kill yourself. So in terms of narratives, I think the narratives I would point to are the negative ones, or the cautionary ones.
Your second chapter is titled Selfies Kill More People Than Sharks. is that true?
I was surprised to find out that this is true, yes. People fall off the edge of the Grand Canyon. They fall off the edge of cliffs. You know, parents have died while taking a picture of themselves, having stepped over the security barrier, and their children were there to watch this happen. I mean, you can Google, I don't know, ridiculous selfie deaths, and they're just astonishing. How people they're so tuned into this performative aspect. I've got to do something that is so fabulous and post-worthy on, well, now X or Instagram or whatever, that I'm willing to risk my life.
You write in the book, quote, "The existence of two minds in a single person is a counterintuitive reality difficult for most people to accept because they firmly feel themselves to be a singular me. That unified feeling is an illusion and explains why it is our inner self with whom we are most often at odds." This comes up in the podcast all the time.
Really?
That individuals want to be...
I'm surprised.
It's across the sciences.
Well, I'm glad it comes up. Yeah, because this has been an old theme of mine for decades.
Yeah. Talk about that, because I'll tell you the context that it's come up here, which is that, and I look at like Goffman's work, who talks about, you know, an onstage, a backstage, you know, offstage self. This idea that we are one consistent person at any given time, when that is entirely not true. The way we behave with family or at work, like it's all these different contexts.
I mean, we think we're rational creatures, but
that
I mean,
too.
the most accurate description would be to say that my behavior is controlled by forces that I do not understand. Now, those forces come from within me, so it still is me, but it's another part of me that I cannot be in touch with very easily. And the reason is that, you know, the consciousness cannot possibly monitor everything we're doing at every given moment. We just don't have the energy for it. So we have to offload it to the subconscious and to automatic processes. I mean, we've all been driving. Driving is such an automatic behavior. And we mean to go someplace else, and we end up going to where we always go for work and all that, because we're not thinking about it. Our bodies are just, you know, going there. We think, oh, wait a minute, where am I I got to turn around and go to the bakery or the shoe store or wherever it is I want to go to. So, there is this other aspect of us. Now, if you talk to creative people, which I do a lot, well, you do a lot.
Yeah.
And you, they often say, no matter what their discipline is that they don't feel like they are the author of the very thing that other people attribute to themselves. I will go back and I'll look at even like a textbook, like my neuropsychology textbook, which is, you know, technical and other. And I'll go back and I'll read a certain paragraph and I'll say, who wrote this?
Mm-hmm.
Did I write this? This is really good. It's like, I don't remember doing this. And it sort of surprises me that where did these thoughts come from? I don't know, you know, but when you're in the zone and when you're working and you're creative, then you're able to free yourself to go beyond the rational mind of I, me, mine, and just get to some really juicy creative part of yourself.
Yeah, and as I'm sure you can imagine, for a really accomplished improviser, that flow state that they're getting into requires just a deep openness to anything that can happen in the moment, because the audience is right there with you. The script is being written with them, by all of us together, and that sense of common discovery together is when the whole audience laughs at the same time.
And you know, in the riffing of a good improviser is no different than a violin virtuoso or a concert pianist. They don't have time to think about what they're doing. They're just playing the music. And as soon as they start to think about, oh, I should, you know, switch keys, I should do this, that, well, it just falls apart.
One of my favorite programs that we developed with the Cleveland Clinic was a group called Caring Cross Generations was called Improvisation for Caregivers. So we would bring improv training to nurses and doctors and home caregivers, people dealing with people with dementia. And this idea of yes and is actually quite useful inside of a lot of those spaces. But what it really is about this sort of deep listening. And I just had a checkup And my regular doctor is on maternity leave. So I was in, and she was great. The new person was great. But she pretty much looked at the computer screen and typed in.
Oh, yes. Well, that's so sad.
And so you do this. You work with medical students.
I do. Yes, I still mentor medical students at George Washington University. And we have what's called patient-centered medicine. So there's nobody is ever a case of anything. They're a person with a certain problem kind of thing. And we have what are called standardized patients who are actors that, who are trained in a script. And so the student takes the hot seat and they go this. And they think at first, oh, this isn't real. I'm going to know it's fake. Well, I can tell you it could be the scenario could be used to common cold or I'm here for my blood pressure. And that student is just sucked right into the scenario, you know, and we can do timeouts and you can ask their peers for, you know, what should I do now? What should I ask, et cetera. We also have the G-Wish program, which is run by a geriatrician who's also a priest.
Oh.
And there's a thing in Assisi every summer for this, and it's about attentive listening. Mm-hmm. You know, how to sit on your hands, bite your tongue, and listen to what the person is telling you, and then you respond to that. You don't come in with a head full of, oh, I want to ask about this, that, and the other, or here's my agenda. It's like you don't have an agenda. You're just there to listen to what they say. You know, I think a patient gets to talk for about, I don't know, 11 to 14 seconds before a doctor typically cuts them off.
Right.
Well, when you actually let them talk, you get more information and more details and more surprising things than you would ever have gotten by a rat-tat-tat-tat-tat machine gun thing like, have you ever had this, that, the other? Tell me this, tell me that. You know, but the best thing is the best responses are tell me and tell me more.
Mm-hmm.
And silence, and then silence draws, and people hate silence. Mm-hmm. And the students hate this too, this, which is why they want to blabber on. And I say, bite your tongue, become comfortable with silence, because silence is what's going to draw out the patient, the other party. And I'm sure this is the same thing in negotiations.
Totally. And the thing is, the silent...
We're in the wrong profession. I should have been a negotiator. You should have been a physician.
Exactly. But this is the thing about the silence is that people desire to be seen and heard. Mm. And when you are quiet and looking at someone and being patient with them, you're seeing and hearing them. So it's us who are the ones who are thinking, wow, this is uncomfortable. It's not the person on the other end. They love it. They love having someone take time with them.
One of the things I teach is that... the most important thing for a patient is that they feel heard and understood. They feel that they have been listened to and their concerns have been taken into consideration and not belittled, not judged, not dismissed, not rushed over.
It's hard. I mean, it's hard.
And you know, you think this would be easy, but it's not, because there's so much of human nature that goes against it. And so, you know, we have to train these young doctors to, you know, bite your tongue, sit on your hands, give people time. What's the rush?
Your chapter 7, this thing was full of stuff that I want to talk to you about.
I'm glad you liked it.
Oh, I loved it. Heldon Hines' gondola kitten experiment.
Oh, yes, yes.
Oh, my God. I read this out loud to my wife, who's also worked here forever, and she's like, that is fascinating. So tell our audience about
it. Oh, do you know that experiment?
I know it now.
It's a classic. It's a classic in it goes back to 1964, I think. Mm-hmm. And it's about passive learning. And so they took two littermates from this, kittens from the same littermate, and they put one of them in a suspended contraption, a gondola-like contraption that moved in parallel with the free exploring kitten. And at the end of it, the passive kitten hadn't learned anything. And it was as blind as it was on the day it was born. Now, cats are born notoriously blind. So, I mean, its vision didn't develop whatsoever. Whereas what animals need to develop vision is to explore the world. I mean, this is why babies crawl all over the floor and put everything in their mouth. You know, they're undergoing a visual apprenticeship with the world. Now, in an update of that experiment, a Chinese-speaking nanny was video filmed so that another child elsewhere was seeing and hearing exactly the same thing that the nanny's charge was seeing. Now, that young boy picked up a good deal of Chinese, actually, because there was a two-way emotional engagement. They're looking each other in the eye. There's the tone of voice, the body language, the prosody of their speech. Whereas the kid who was passively watching all this didn't learn a single phrase of Chinese. So this is just, again, verifies that passive learning is no good. Doesn't work. Now, it would be wonderful. I'm the first one to say this. It would be wonderful if we could jack in the way they do in the Matrix films. And within 10 seconds, oh, I know how to fly a V-12 helicopter. I know how to do this. I know how to do that. Well, you know, learning takes time, which is why school takes so long. It takes practice and repetition and persistence to do it. And also hard work. I had a favorite teacher in prep school, Mr. Bamman, who taught physics. And my God, the homework that he gave us, I would be up at night till 11 o'clock sitting at the kitchen table with a sheet of graph paper, a slide rule and a mechanical calculator all weekends doing the same thing. And, you know, he wasn't being mean. He knew that we could do the work and we did it. And I look back and thank God he was so firm with us that he really believed in us. And so he, you know, my hardest teacher was also my favorite teacher.
Yeah. Embodied learning is exactly what we do. And it's the reason so many actors, when they're learning their lines, they learn it during blocking because they're moving. And it just makes you think, like, I think about my entire, like, you know, both early childhood and elementary school, which is just like sit down.
Rote learning. Yeah.
There's
the times
a movement.
Tables.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it was like you had to sit down and be quiet. And it's like, and then you're like, well, we have pretty robust scientific evidence that says that movement is part of this. And we all have a couple of those teachers. Mine was my fifth grade teacher, Mr. McPherson, who ended up getting fired, of course. He had us, we were on our feet. We were moving. He was devising scenarios in which we would, you know, create environments in which we'd be learning. So we'd be in it. If we were learning about law, we would be in a courtroom.
And oh, it was how nice.
And just that physical act. And it was so, like, to this day, you know, however many decades later, that's what I remember. I don't remember the times table when I was sitting at my desk.
Me neither.
Yeah.
Erica Christakis talks about this, that young students aren't, they're not seat ready for schoolwork. You know, that's the educators wants to impose this schedule on them when in fact young kids, they want a whole different method. And this is why, like, the German Kinderfahrt or the French Classe Verte, the green class, where the kids as young as three are taken out to the country for a long weekend with their teachers. No cell phones are allowed. The teachers say to the parents, we'll call you if we need to, you know, and for the most part, the parents are glad to have the time to themselves. But, you know, they learn by playing, by making up their own games, by negotiating the rules, by settling their arguments. Older students help the younger ones, etc. So it's very much a hands-on kind of thing.
So I'm interesting sort of journey as a parent with education. So when our son was ready to go to school, the British school had just opened in Chicago, and it was just down the street from our home at the time. And we're Anglophiles, so we got him in his uniform, and he went there. And he actually had a really wonderful first semester, terrible second semester. And we're like, this doesn't feel right. And my wife discovered a school I had never heard of, and it was the Chicago Waldorf School. And their early childhood program was play-based and story-based, and there were scarves and they made
knitting and felt work and sculpture. Yeah, I mean, it's
amazing. So, and you talk in the book about Waldorf schools as being one of the best-kept secrets in education. Why do you say that?
Because it is. There aren't that many of them in the country, really. And I think the telling thing is that almost all the Silicon Valley executives send their children to the Waldorf school in the peninsula. Yeah. They do not want their children exposed to the technology that they have invented. And in fact, they make their nannies and their housekeepers sign non-disclosure agreements that they will not use cell phones or any kind of screen in the presence of their children, or else they'll be fired summarily. So what does that kind of hypocrisy tell you?
No, it's terrible. So and I know at the school, there's certain parents who really got impatient because the kids were learning to write and read a little bit later than the kids.
But who needs in Germany, they don't teach you to read and write until the sixth grade.
Exactly.
So we had spot run in the first grade. Okay. Well, I happen to like reading, so I'm not the best example. But there's no need to, and they don't have the motor skills, and this is the fine motor skills at that young age, to be doing this. But there's a connection between the brain and the writing hand, the writing arm, the writing fingers. You know, three fingers may hold the pen, but the entire brain is active in the act of writing. And this is why the loss of cursive writing is such a tragedy, because your signature, this is why your signature is like totally unique, and why you can look at historical signatures and say, oh my God, that's Thomas Jefferson, that's Adolf Hitler, that's George Washington, whomever, you know, John Hancock, obviously, that is famous. And printing just bypasses all that. And then even worse is when students are taking notes on their iPads.
Yeah.
And I say, don't do that. When you take notes via an iPad, you're transcribing the lecture. You're not listening to it. Whereas if you listen to the lecture and you have a pen in your hand and you write down a judicious phrase or two, and then when you get back to your room, your dorm, at the end of the school day, you sit down and you look over what you've written, and then you write it out again in your own hand. So, and if you can do that, then you've really understood it. And if you come to a point where a stumbling block, well, that's the sign that this is what you don't understand, and here's where you need remedial work.
The other thing about Waldorf too is that as a parent, they're like, you gotta have the rain pants, you gotta have the boots, you gotta have the gloves, because they go outside unless it is lightning hitting the ground, they're outside every day. And they've moved our school, but in both places they've got wonderful outdoor spaces, gardens, and that sort of thing. And the kids are getting in touch with nature. I literally had this moment. I was halfway through your book, and I was getting a little bit tired. I'm like, oh, I'm going to go out for a walk and go down to the coffee shop, grab a coffee, and come back, because I just wanted to be outside, look at the sky, look at the trees, reset my brain a little bit to then go back and dig in. And that's a thing like I do all the time. And it's amazing how refreshing that is. And I live in an urban environment. I can't do forest bathing as much as like some.
Well, you know, it doesn't take, you don't have to go be in a national park to enjoy the greenery. A single tree, you can sit under a tree for your lunch, or just walk in your neighborhood and look at the bushes, look at the grass, look at this, the other. Everybody knows that nature is restorative. You only have to go for a walk in the woods or on the beach to understand that this is true. But we don't need that depth of forest bathing, as you say. You reminded me of something when you talked about actors learning their lines during blocking. And that's so true. And I used to be an actor at Duke and earlier even. That it reminds me, it's the same thing as the method of loci, which the Roman statesman would have a speech they wanted to deliver in the forum. And so they would walk around their house and put their hand on the wall. And as they reached this section, all right, I'm going to say point A. And they would go to another location. This is what loci mean, locations. And they would do the same thing. So blocking is very much like this. I mean, I'm standing next to this table, this piece of furniture. I'm downstage. I'm upstage. I've got this character who I'm addressing. And all those are nonverbal cues as to what comes next. And when we can't think of what comes next, we say line.
Yeah.
and we get a prompt.
Yeah. One thing that was really interesting, you say that vision accounts for 85% of all inputs to the brain.
Yeah.
Wow. I that was a surprise to me until I read further, but because I just think about sound and how quickly that moves. But then when you talk about the human face and what we're reading from that, and actually how vision over time, like back in the Stone Age, like seeing the danger way more important than necessarily hearing, because hearing, you just don't know necessarily what you're hearing. But if you see it peripherally or otherwise, you know to get yourself into a safe space. So the idea that these visual cues are so important in how we read each other's faces, that the face tells those stories. Yeah.
And you know, a baby learns how to read another human being long before they learn how to speak. Mm. Okay, so we say, oh, language is so rational, you know. Well, there's other things that are operating in the background that are far more powerful. So, you know, a baby's vision is about 2400, so they're almost blind, really. But there's nothing more fascinating to an infant than another human face. Their eyes lock onto it, the pupils dilate, they coo and giggle. I mean, every parent and grandparent knows this, you know. And so this is why I say, you know, putting an iPad in the over the bassinet or the iPod-y or the seat in the back of the car, that's a form of child abuse, because you are blocking the developing central vision of a young developing brain. And they need to see other people. They need to hear adults speak to them in full sentences. Linguistically competent adults. A screen talks at a child. It doesn't talk with them. Mm-hmm. But when you play the games with them that you played as a young kid, you know, Patty Cake, So Big, later on, more imaginative games like Grocery Store or Restaurant, these stimulate the imagination, and these also engage them socially. Because you've heard of the first chapter where I talk about the Stone Age clan. Well, we are social animals, and the most important thing for us to do is socialize, which is why, you know, social media is such a ridiculous oxymoron. There's nothing social about it. It is isolating. It makes people depressed. And it interferes with their ability to, well, for example, young people, including medical school students, but also, you know, college kids, they don't know how to make small talk. They don't know how to talk to somebody. They're so terrified that they have to speak with another person that they pretend they've got a message coming or something in order to avoid you. We've seen this all the time. People coming down the street, what do? They hold their phone up so they don't have to look you in the eye. This is spooky.
Yeah. You know, we do 400, 500 corporate engagements a year, learning engagements. And overwhelmingly in the last like 18 months, it has been, can you come in and help? Because the different generations in our business don't know how to talk to each other.
Yes. Well, it's understandable.
Yeah. And they are unpracticed.
Because they haven't talked to one another. I mean, for example, they're terrified of doorbells. They don't know what to do. And they're expecting a text that says, we're here outside. The same thing when the telephone rings. Like,
oh, they don't like to be called.
Don't tell me. No. This is like, I mean, the most terrifying words you can get in a message are call me.
Yeah.
They don't like to do that.
No, they don't.
But so, in fact, that's the best thing for them.
Right, is being able to have it. And again, when we go in to do this, they love it. They have fun. They're laughing. Mm. They're you know, but they don't know.
And, well, you know, when kids are sent away to boot camp, let's say their parents have had it and they're going to put on a digital detox and all that. So they're sent away to some place like Hillary Cash's Restart. And all the screens are taken away. Their phones are taken away. And they have to talk with one another. They have to talk with the staff. They have to talk during meal times, and they have to go outside, right? Mm-hmm. Like for most of the day, you're inside to eat your meals and go to sleep. Other than that, you're outdoors and you're engaged with everybody else and with the real world.
So in a moment, I'm going to ask you for a yes and story, which we always ask our guests at the end. But before we do that, my friend Nir Eyal, I quote this all the time because he has a phrase that says it's not a superpower unless it can also be used for evil. And so I think that's kind of what it is with some of these devices, right? Because you're not a druid. You've got your iPhone there. You're not necessarily anti-technology, but I think what you're saying, and tell me if I'm right, is that no, this stuff is so powerful that it can have incredible damage in addition to the things that make it so wonderful for us to use to get to know how to get somewhere, say.
Oh, it's a wonderful tool, but we have to know when to put it down and when to take breaks from it and when to return to socializing. You know, Aristotle said man is a political animal, and he didn't mean that we're interested in matters of state, but that we live in a polis, a city of other people. And so, you know, it takes a village. And unfortunately, everybody's in their own little world. They're not in the village anymore. Mm-hmm. And that's what we need to get back to. And it could start, you know, in kindergarten. And it could start with actually training parents that why does your first grader need a cell phone? Why do you need to reach them at any moment? You know, when I was in school, if something came up, my mother would call the principal's office, you know, and nothing ever came up.
No. Yeah, no.
You left in the morning and you came back, you know, in the afternoon. And then, you know, we changed clothes and we rode our bikes out with our friends and all that. And we just needed to come back in time for dinner or when the streetlights came on. They didn't worry.
No,
they weren't afraid that we were going to be, I don't know, abducted by aliens or something.
Yeah, we just interviewed Kirk Gray about his book Outraged, and he talks about the fact that as societies become more fair, that's when our moral outrage actually gets even higher. Mm-hmm. So he tells that story about that mom who let a kid was misbehaving in the car, kicked them out of the car to walk the six blocks home, and got arrested.
There's a famous parents here in Montgomery County, Maryland, who let their children, they're Russian and mm-hmm. or Eastern European, and so they let their children walk to school in the daylight. And Montgomery County Protective Services swooped in and made the parents sign this, you know, 5-page order that they would never let the kids out. Da, da, da. And so then the kids did it again on their own accord, and they came back for the parents. I mean, it's like, what kind of craziness is this?
Wow.
You know, this protective stuff is overly protective. It's the nanny state gone berserk.
Yeah. All right. We always ask our guests for a yes and story. So the idea here is that in improvisation, when you're making something out of nothing, you get nowhere by saying no. You actually don't get that far by saying yes. You say yes and. You affirm and contribute. And you do that in order to explore and heighten and get to an abundant amount of ideas. So I'm wondering if you have a yes and story for us.
Well, I was away at an artist colony, and I was got this email, and I shouldn't be checking the email while I'm away trying to work on a new book, but I did, and it was an invitation to this conference in Baltimore, and it was very flattering and all that, and I thought, well, I don't know, but it's Baltimore. It's a quick drive from D.C., and I thought about it. Well, you know, it's good exposure. It's good publicity. I was rationalizing, and so I said, okay, yes, and but I'll need you to do a book signing, set up a book signing there, because that's what I sell books, you know. Uh-huh. So I went, and it was really an awful kind of thing. It was like I don't know who these organizers were, and the attendees were even more out to lunch with it, and we set up some books and all that, but nobody really bought anything. So it was like, well, this was a waste of time. But again, you never know.
Yeah.
You have to try.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because if you don't say yes, you'll never get anywhere.
Exactly. The book is called Your Stone Age Brain in the Screen Age. Richard Cytowic, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Adulthood, no one survives.